All right, good morning. It's not big enough. All right, it's not necessary. Yeah. Okay. We're going to continue studying Purim. Today what we're going to do is basically two things, two objectives. The first is to understand why the name of Purim is Purim, okay? And through doing that, we're going to study the third chapter of the Megillat Esther, and that will help us understand a little bit why the name is called Purim, and so we're going to do those two things, okay? All right, so first we'll ask some questions, and then we will go through the text, and then we will give some answers. Okay, so the first question is, what does Purim mean, and why is the holiday called that?
It means lots.
Exactly. So it means lots, like a lottery. And so that is the way that Haman decided which time period, which day, which month to make his plan to annihilate the Jewish people. So the question is that a reason to call the holiday Purim? Call it Holiday of Esther, Holiday of Mordechai, Holiday of Salvation, right? We're basically calling the holiday by the name of the way in which we were almost annihilated. It's a little bit strange.
Why not?
Okay, so that's a valid point. So you're saying, why not? It has to do with the story, so why not? Okay, fine. So we'll see. But it's still a question to be raised. Okay? Some other questions which we will try to answer is, why did Haman wait so long to kill the Jews? And we'll see in the text what I mean by that. And why was he so set on making a lottery in the first place? So we will, through that analyzing Haman using a lottery to choose when to annihilate the Jewish people, when to try to do that. So we will read the third chapter and try to get some answers. Okay? Fine. So we'll go through the verses and we'll give some back. One second. We'll give some background and some insight as we go along. And if you have a question or a comment on any of the verses, feel free to raise them and share them. Yes.
I only have a comment on the verses. What book?
Well, we didn't do them yet.
What book is the story of Purim in?
Okay, so the story of Purim is in the Scroll of Esther, Megillat Esther.
It's in the Book of Esther?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so after these events, which events? This is the third chapter. So which events? So the events of the party in which Ahasuerus threw for his subjects and the Jewish people attended, even though Mordechai told them better not to attend, they still attended. That's when he called for Vashti to appear, and she did not want to. By the way, the Talmud in the Tractate of Megillah, the Gemara, goes through a lot of the verses, and it expounds them, and it adds a lot of background. So we don't have time to go through all of it, but it's very fascinating. Perhaps for another time, it gives a lot of background as to who these people were, and their lineage, and their genealogy, and that helps explain some of the story and how the characters interact with one another. Okay? But Vashti, of course, refuses to appear. Ahasuerus gets angry. He does away with her. There's actually a question whether she's just sent away, sent far away. She's exiled. or her life was ended. It seems that there's a question as to which of the two happened. But either way, she's sent away. The king, Ahasuerush, wants to replace his queen, makes a pageant. Esther, of course, goes, does not reveal that she's Jewish. Haman steps in, and he also makes the comment why he basically is saying that women are not they're not listening to their husbands like
they're
they should.
Obedient.
They're not obedient, right? They're doing whatever they want, and we have to put a stand. We have to put a stop to that.
No, good for them.
They had an early start.
Yeah. I know. It wouldn't be accepted nowadays, but back then it was different. And then, so basically, and the Talmud tells us that Haman was not. So the Ahasuerus had seven advisors, we're told, and Haman Mehuman, as he's known beforehand, is not like the top one, but he's Kafatz L'Rosh. He jumps to the front. I think there's an English quote, which is that fools jump in,
where angels fear to tread.
Angels or wise men.
Wise men.
I think it's wise men. Where wise men fear to tread, fools jump in. Okay, so I think that that's the verse it's a verse actually somewhere, and it's applied to Haman. Meaning, basically, Haman took charge, right? He jumped to the front, even though he wasn't necessarily the wisest or the most qualified advisor, but he jumped all the way to the front to become the advisor to the king. And so now, whatever he says seems to resonate with Ahasuerus. And Ahasuerush, the king, seems to listen to whatever Haman has to say. Okay, so that's where...
It says here he advanced him above all the others.
Yeah. So it was Ahasuerush, you said. Yeah. So that's a good point. So I think it's not necessarily a contradiction. It could be that Haman, if he would have not said what he said about the women and their houses and everything like that, he would have remained number seven or whatever it was. Because he started doing that, he must have done some things that made Ahasuerus like him, and so Ahasuerus promoted him. So you're right. But he couldn't have done it on his own. It has to be that Ahasuerus wanted him to be at the front. So it was he lobbied his way to the top, and so he made Ahasuerus want to promote him. Okay, so Haman is brought up to the top advisor. B'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech, and so all the king's servants who were in the king's gate would kneel and would prostrate themselves before Haman, for so had the king commanded concerning him. But Mordechai would neither kneel nor prostrate himself. Okay, so there's a couple things. So first of all, it sounds like Ahasuerus had told everyone that Haman is to be bowed down to, right? That so he's really, you know, saying, you know, this is my guy, and you need to obey him. Whatever he says, you need to bow down whenever he walks by. There's a question.
Rabbi.
One second. There's a question. Whether Haman was... So basically, Mordechai refuses to bow down because, we're going to see, because he says he was Jewish. So the question is, so what does that have to do with anything? So the answer is that there was idolatry involved. So the question is, the Talmud has two opinions. Was it that Haman himself made himself out to be a god, and therefore by bowing down to him, you're acknowledging that he is the Avodah Zarah? Or another opinion is that he wore around his neck some sort of pendant or some form of idolatry, a small idol around his neck, and therefore by bowing down to him, you're really bowing down to the idol, and so that's what he didn't want to do. So, but either way, Mordechai refused to bow down. Now, it could be that even if you say that Haman, forget the idolatry part, you could say a third explanation, which is that to bow down to anything other than God and to acknowledge an evil human being is not what we should be doing as a Jewish people. Meaning, even if it's not idolatry, but it's still showing that you're obeying the whims of this guy, that we shouldn't do. That's not necessarily a Jewish value. Meaning, we respect the Pirkei Avot says we should respect the
leader.
Government, the leaders. But that doesn't mean we should bow down to them. We should keep things in perspective. So, with all those reasons, Mordechai refused to do so. Now, the question is, if he would have known that Haman would get so angry, we'll see that he decides to do a drastic thing, would Mordechai have still done it? So the answer is might be yes, or it might be to save the Jewish people, or it might be no, because we know that for idolatry, one is obligated to give up their life and not to serve. So along those lines, perhaps he would have refused to bow down under any circumstances, whatever, even if he knew what Haman would decide to do afterwards. Yes, do you have a question?
Well, there were some people here who didn't have
the sheets? Yeah, okay. I have three more.
Okay, I just want one for
you. Okay, do you mind?
For me.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so then, verse 3. Then the king's servants who were in the king's gate said to Mordechai, why do you disobey the king's orders? Okay, so they asked him why. So now it came to pass when they said this to him daily and he did not listen to them that they told Haman. So it sounds like at first Haman didn't necessarily notice that there was this older Jew who didn't bow down, presumably because, if you think about modern day Iran, not that I've been there, but you think about, their palaces and their big courtyards and how they all, Muslims bow down for prayer, and there's a lot of them, and it's like this big square. So it could be that out of like 1,000 people or even 100 people that were there, so he didn't necessarily notice at first one Jew in the back who was just sitting there and not bowing down. Now, another question that comes to mind is why did Mordechai not just leave the area and just stay in the study house? Why was he even out there to begin with? So, in another place in the Megillah, we're told that Mordechai stayed by the gate of the king because he still wanted to be involved in hearing what was going on. So it could be that he felt that he had reason to be there just like anybody else. And this crazy guy is walking by, wants everyone to bow down to him, and he didn't want to. But he didn't feel like he needed to run away. Yeah.
He may have had some important position because they came and asked him. They didn't just punish him or something. They came and asked him. He may have had some position.
Recognition.
Where he had to be there.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They noticed, why didn't you?
That's a good point, right. I mean, meaning if he was just randomly there and he wasn't well known, so they wouldn't have even asked him. Although he could have stood out, if everyone's bowing down and one guy is standing in the back. But I agree with you. I think he did have reason to be there. Acceptable. To see whether Mordechai's words would stand up, that's maybe a play on words in the Megillah, to see whether his words would stand up, meaning to see if they were testing him to see if he would actually continue to go through with this. But I think it's a play on words, maybe. Because it's saying that he stood up instead of bowing down. But it's referring to his words. So. Okay, that just came to mind. He gave them Asher Hu Yehudi, because he told them that he was a Jew. Meaning, now they're going to say, oh, okay, he told them he was a Jew. And so we just explained a couple minutes ago what that means. So what does it mean that he was a Jew and therefore he didn't bow down? So we explained that. So now they're basically seeing it's a showdown. The next time, now they know now they know that he's specifically not bowing down. It's not just that he forgets to. And we're going to see, obviously Haman is this, you know, this aggressive person because he pushed himself to the top. So it's going to come to a head. So, and when Haman saw that Mordechai would neither kneel nor prostrate himself before him, he became full of wrath. He became very angry. Why did he become angry? So either it's because he wasn't shown respect by this guy, and he wanted to be shown respect, I think that's basically the simple understanding, is that everyone else was doing it, and he wasn't doing it, and why aren't you doing it? You should be like everybody else. I'm Haman. Okay, fine. Now the next verse, I think I even put it on your sheet. Yeah, it's a hard verse to translate.
How did you call those who wasn't Jewish? Who were they? Those.
At this moment.
Yeah, Jewish, and who is the reverse? Who's not Jewish?
At this moment in the story.
Then.
I'm not sure what you mean.
You call them Goyim, but how did you call them? Then, you know, that were Jewish and not Jewish.
I'm not sure they were referred to anything specific. I think we see that Yehudim is referring to the Jews, and it's just assumed that everyone else in the story is not. Like, Avdei HaMelech, the servants of the king. If it doesn't say that they were Jewish, so presumably they weren't. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, the word Goyim is not used in a text anyway. She's asking what the non-Jews in the story were referred to, but I'm not sure.
They call them Christians yet.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Well, they were. I don't think they were Christians yet. Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure. Okay. So the next verse is hard to translate from the Hebrew to the English. We'll read how it's translated here. It seemed contemptible to him to lay a hand on Mordechai himself, because they told him Mordechai's nationality. And Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout Ahasuerus' entire kingdom, Mordechai's people. So the question is, why couldn't he just say, I just want to get rid of Haman himself, Mordechai himself? Why is it contemptible to him to lay hands on Mordechai alone? Because they told him
Mordechai's people.
So it could mean that he didn't want to be seen as someone that just as petty that he would go after one person and for no reason. Meaning, why are you going after one person? It's petty. But then they told him, as I'm Mordechai. No, they told him it was part of a bigger, he wasn't just making this choice on his own Mordechai. It was because of his religious background and his nationality. And so now he has a reason, Haman maybe says to himself, now I can get rid of all of them. And I'll come up with I'll fabricate a reason, which we'll see. He'll tell Achashverosh why he doesn't think that the Jewish people have any value. And that way he can get rid of Mordechai and the rest of them. And then he can avoid looking like he's petty, that he's just going after one guy. I could be off, because who says that Haman cares about that? Do you have a theory?
I think this is always with minorities. From childhood on, we divide ourselves into we and they.
Okay.
The children we play with, the children we don't. It's we and they. And this continues through adulthood.
Okay.
And we like football. We, our team, their team.
Yeah.
And the we see as individuals. This is the rabbi, this is Judy, and this. And the they we see as a stereotype.
Okay.
So this is the thing with minorities. They're seen as a stereotype, whether unusually bad, and this is the helplessness of the minority.
Uh-huh. So you're saying he didn't seem...
Mordecai had been important, so it would be a petty thing, and so he's going to get rid of the whole minority.
They're
bowing to him. It just talks about Mordecai not bowing. So why are you punishing everybody?
Yeah.
That's what is always done with the theys, with the minority.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
One second. Hold on. He was being of the shachar Mordechai levado, because Mordechai, because they told him.
It just says Mordechai didn't bow down. I'm sure the Jewish people bowed down to royalty, to the prime minister, to everyone. They would be shunned if they didn't do that. So he takes the individual and. It's right here in the...
It could be, it could be a different reason also. It could be the opposite.
Yeah.
Meaning, it could be read, because they... And this would be Haman showing respect, so you'll see what I mean. It could be that Haman says to himself, well, he has a reason for not doing it. It's not because he doesn't like me personally. He... is only not bowing, he's only refusing to bow because of religious reasons. So he says, it would be petty for me to, to single out this Jew. He's part of the Jewish people, and I understand that the Jewish people don't bow down to idols. So I need to come up with another reason.
But it doesn't say that the people didn't bow down.
No, that's fine.
It
but
just says Mordecai.
No, you're right.
Sure, they did bow down because they would have been punished if they...
I think you're right. I think the Talmud says that they all did it. But what I'm saying is, it could be that Haman thought, okay, well, those people don't follow, they're scared. But I can understand why Mordechai is not bowing down. And I want to respect his religion.
No, he doesn't.
Listen, so I'll come up with another reason for getting rid of them. I don't care about the religion. I just don't like them, and I don't like that he's bowing down to me. But I can't single him out. So what I'll do is I'll come up with other reasons. I'll tell Achashverosh, get rid of them for other reasons. So let's keep going, and we'll see. Okay, so in the first month, which is in the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of Achashverosh, someone cast the poor, which is the lot, right? This is like our topic. He basically cast lots. He did like a lottery with stones or with papers. And it was before Haman, so it's Rashi raises the question. Haman wasn't doing it. It was done before Haman. So it could have been someone else was doing it with him, like his son, one of his sons. Right? We know he had a lot of sons that were, obviously helping. Yeah, they were helping him. So it could be... So, miyom miyom namei chodesh l'chodesh, shneimasar hu chodesh adar. From month to month... to the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So basically, he does this lot. So the first question is why it's weird, because he's doing this lot to determine a certain date. Which date? A date that he would decide to destroy the Jewish people. Now it shows that he was premeditated. because he didn't even discuss it yet with Ahasuerus, right? He basically is doing this, and then he's going to go to Ahasuerus. So it's a little bit strange. It's a little bit out of order. Why is he, what's he doing a lot for? He doesn't even know that he'll have the power to kill the Jewish people. So it could be that he was so excited, you know, he was a horrible person. He was so enthralled with this idea that he came up with that he couldn't wait. So he needed to do it. So the question is, why is he drawing a lot, right? Why didn't he just say, okay, I'm going to annihilate them next week? So this is where you need like the Talmud. So basically, at that time, not like nowadays, at that time they were in touch a little bit more with spiritual type things. Even Haman is doing casting lots. He's because not just randomly, but he thinks that there's powers at play that he could count on to figure out when the spiritually weakest point for the Jews is and when he can have a chance to go at them. Because he realizes that God might be helping them, and therefore he doesn't think he'll be successful at any time. He needs a optimal time. So he does lots because he thinks that way some power... It's pretty clear, you could see throughout the Talmud, that he does have some sort of belief in God. There are hints to that, where he acknowledges certain things, and he knows certain things about the Jewish people. He was pretty familiar, but yet he was hell-bent on destroying us. So he determined a couple things. So he determined that Adar had no special holidays in it, right? Up to that point, right? Nisan had Passover, had Pesach, and the beginning, like Tishrei, as Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. But up to this point, Adar, we only know it as Purim, because that's what we have nowadays, but at this point, he's like, oh, the 12th month. Yeah, they don't do anything. That's a month before Passover. They don't have anything special, any special holidays, any special merits. That seems like a perfect time. So he goes with that. Now, it could be God behind the scenes, or it is God behind the scenes saying, do it in Adar, because at this point, it's Nisan. So it's a whole... 11 and a half weeks later, 11 and a half months later. It's almost a year later. So he's giving the Jewish people a whole year to figure it out, to repent, right, to pray. He could have found a different time, but he was basically left with a whole year. So the question is, why didn't he change? Why didn't he say, wait a second, that's too far. I don't want to wait that long. But he says, no. Okay, so there's another reason that that the Talmud discusses why he decided that Adar was a good time, because Moshe died on the 7th of Adar, right? So he said, oh. So this is an example of how he was very familiar. So he said, oh, Moses died. Their leader died. This is actually a very auspicious time for me to strike, because it shows that this is a weak month for them when their leader died. The Talmud says, but he didn't know that Moses was also born in Adar. And so, okay, so what difference does that make? So one could explain that it's known that the righteous are born and they pass away on the same... take that back. There are certain righteous people that have passed away and that have been born on the same day, and that sort of shows like a complete life. Obviously, it doesn't happen to every righteous person, but in this case, I think, I don't know if it was the exact same day. No, yeah, it is. The Talmud says it was the 7th of Adar that he was born, and the 7th of Adar they passed away, showing that he was like a complete, he had a complete life. It was exact. So So therefore, it's also a time of rejoicing for the Jewish people, because that's when he was born. So, but Haman didn't know that. So why didn't he? He knew when he died, but not when he was born. So I don't know. It could be that, you know, Moses, when he died, it was more of a well-known thing because he was already the leader. But when he was born, it was hard to know when he was born because he wasn't well-known at that point. So, okay, whatever. There's another deeper reasoning, which gets a little bit, like, mystical, which is that the sign, right, there's different, even Judaism has, it's not the same thing as modern-day astrology. Maybe this could be for another talk. A different time about astrology and Judaism, but there we do believe in signs. So the sign for the month of Adar is fish, and fish live underwater. And there's this idea that the Ayin Hara, that the evil eye, again, that could be part of this discussion, what it actually means. But there's an idea that if something can't be seen, so it's guarded from the evil eye, and it's less prone to harm. So fish, which is the month of Adar, are less prone to harm, and so that's also why it happened to be a good month for the Jewish people, in that, you know, Haman already from the beginning would have a hard time to attack the Jews. Okay. So let's keep going. And Haman said to King Ahasuerus. So this is where he comes up with his reasons why the Jewish people deserve to be destroyed. There's a certain people scattered and separate among the peoples throughout all the provinces of your kingdom, and their laws are different from everyone else. And they don't keep your laws. And therefore, you have no reason to let them live. So the commentaries explain a couple things. He's saying that they're spread out, so meaning they're just these people. Some are here, some are there. They're not like a unified force that could support you. There's no reason to keep them around. On a deeper level, it's said that they weren't unified themselves, and so that's another reason why we can strike against them. Mufuzar, mufurad, that they themselves were scattered. They themselves were not united.
Is this part of the chosen? We consider ourselves the chosen one.
We're chosen for not just for good things, but for bad things.
The world to justice. I think the word is different. Human beings cannot take differences.
Yeah.
I can say one experience. When I was 9 years old, I was playing with three little girls.
Mm-hmm.
One was deaf.
Mm-hmm.
The other two girls got behind her, and they were saying nasty things about her to me and laughing because they knew she couldn't hear. That's in human beings different, and that's the word.
I hear. So, right, so the question is, so did they really believe, were they really to that level where, oh, they're different? It could be that. But keep in mind that before Haman, so no one else suggested this. No one else had a problem. This was already the 12th year. They've already been around for 12 years. So only until Haman comes around and convinces Ahasuerus, even though it could be that Ahasuerus wanted to do it the whole time and he was maybe just waiting, you know, till someone, you know, did it. He couldn't do it, but someone else could do it. Or this could just be a pretext. Really, they didn't care. But they needed to come up with some reason why. Okay, so either way, they don't keep the king's laws. But actually, the commentaries say it doesn't just mean that they have different laws. They say that the Jewish people don't seem to be paying the right taxes. and they're not, you know, subservient to you in that way. I don't know if that's true, that they weren't doing that, but that could be another interpretation. Okay, so in verse 9, if it pleases the king, let it be written to destroy them, and I will weigh out 10,000 silver coins into those who perform the work to bring it into king's treasuries. So I had a hard time understanding this verse in years past, but I think it means that Haman, even though the king had probably had all the money that he needed, but Haman was saying, "I'll give you $10,000, right, in those times, to destroy them." Meaning, and so how would he get that? So I think it's that he would, once the Jews were destroyed, Haman would plunder them, take all their money, and give this portion back to the king. So he's basically bribing the king to let him destroy the Jewish people. Again, I would think that he would have, the king doesn't need this money, but maybe he did. So anyway, the king took off his hand, the ring off his hand, and gave it to Haman, the adversary of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The silver is given to you and the people to do to them as it pleases you." This is why I'm not sure about the silver thing, because here it sounds like the king saying that the silver, you can take the silver. So maybe it could be that he was saying, "I need $10,000 to pay for people to destroy the Jews." Okay, so that's why I'm not sure. Because in 9, it sounds like Haman will give the money to give it to the king, but the king is now saying, "You can have the money." So that's what I'm not sure about. But there was money involved in this kind of thing. Okay, there's a whole question whether Ahasuerus, whether he really was just the simpleton that kind of was swayed by Haman and couldn't care either way, or if he was evil himself inside and he was actually very happy that Haman was saying, "Let's destroy them." And so, like in this verse, you could do whatever you want. So that's a question, a big question in the Talmud as to the character of Ahasuerus. Was he an evil person, or was he just a simpleton that could be swayed either way, and he changed his mind all the time? You saw that with Vashti, that he was actually, after it happened, he regretted. He was
easily influenced.
Yeah, but he regretted what he did to Vashti. So, meaning he was, like, petulant. Like, he just, you know, decided on a whim, "I'll do this," and then the next day he said, "Oh, I shouldn't have done that." Okay. So, verse 12, "And the king's scribes were summoned in the first month on the 13th day." So this is Nisan, right before Passover, which is the 15th. "And it was written according to everything that Haman had told," that the governors. Okay, basically, there were letters written out to everyone in the kingdom. "This is what we're going to do to the Jewish people." Okay? "The letters should be sent to everyone to destroy, kill, and cause to perish all the Jewish people, young and old, children, women, on one day, the 13th of the 12th month, Adar." So it's like exactly 11 months later. "And their spoils to be taken as plunder." Meaning, we're going to destroy them, we're going to take their money. And then it said that it was an edict to be given to everyone, published, to be ready for that day. And then it said that the couriers, right, the postal men, they ran out and they sent all these letters to everyone. And then the king and Haman sat down to drink. They were satisfied. They were relaxed. They were celebrating, perhaps. Va'ir Shushan Navocha. Where we read that last line in a sad tone, the city of Shushan was Navocha, was perplexed, was confused, was worried, was upset, sad, all these different emotions, because they saw what was happening. Again, the question is, this was 11 months later. It could have been next week. So they perhaps had solace in the fact that they had, even though at that moment, obviously, they were terrified. But I'm just, from a bird's eye view, well, wait a second. It's 11 months. They're telling you it's going to be 11 months, right? It's kind of like an army saying to another army, we're going to attack you in exactly 11 months and 2 days. It's a little bit strange. So I think that that's showing the hand of God that it didn't just wasn't just a surprise attack. They were kind of saying when they would do it. Again, Haman thought that that was the best time to do it. But it did give the Jewish people time. And then, of course, with Esther, and then she gets to influence the king on from her side, the different parties, and saving the Jewish people, of course. So Haman left the door open for us to step in. But obviously at that moment, they weren't thinking that. They didn't know what would happen. Okay, so just going back to so that's the third chapter, okay? So what I want to do, finishing off, is answer the questions we raised at the beginning. Why the name Purim, right? Why name the holiday after the mode and method of our enemies that tried to kill us, right? Name it celebration of Esther. Name the holiday, holiday of salvation, right? Why name it Purim? Okay, so you hit on one of the answers, which is that God reversed the scales of chance in our favor. This is the miracle of Purim, meaning the whole story is where you think one thing is happening, and then all of a sudden, v'nahafochu, it was switched around, right? You think Vashti's the queen? No, all of a sudden it's Esther, right? You think that Haman's on top? No, Mordechai is the one that gets led by Haman across the streets, right? Everything gets switched. You think that Haman's going to destroy us? In the end, Haman gets destroyed. Everything is the opposite. So it's the same thing, right? With the lots, right? We think that that Haman was going to destroy us with these lots, but in the end, again, like we're saying, perhaps it was the lots that saved us because it gave us time to then. So there's also an idea, besides everything we said before, that Ein Mazal LiYisrael. There's no such thing that the Jews are necessarily ruled by the constellations, meaning there's this concept that certain time periods, certain months had certain influences on a person's character and on what happened in the world. All right? Whether that's still true, we don't really sort of know about these things, but there is that concept, at least back then. So, but there's an idea that the Jewish people are not ruled by these things. That if the Jewish people, call out to God and, repent for things that they've done, so it doesn't matter that there's like an edict, set that, oh, the Jewish people are in trouble on this date. God doesn't care about that. So, the verses say later on that Mordechai and Esther established the days of Purim as days of happiness and of feasting and of giving presents to one another. Why? So they said we should do that, A, to celebrate the miracle that we were saved, and also, one second, also to promote unity and goodwill and to show that the Jewish people are strongest when we're united, right? So it's a day of celebrating together, and that's why we give to the poor and we give to each other, right? To foster the sense of unity. So, yeah, did you have a point?
I never thought about why do children do the Gregors when Haman's name is called.
Yeah.
Until I saw a movie called The Producers.
Okay.
And in The Producers, they make a production.
Yeah, Springtime for Hitler. Yeah, yeah, I'm familiar.
And they're making fun of Hitler.
I know.
There's a Nazi sitting, he can't stand it. They're making fun of Hitler. And that is what the children do with the Gregors.
Yeah.
They're ridiculing Haman.
Yeah.
And ridicule, that's the worst to a powerful person.
Yes.
Ridicule is the worst.
Right.
And I didn't understand. I mean, to me, it was my husband and we would make Purim parties. The children would
go
to shul.
Yeah, right, right.
But when I saw that and the laughter at Hitler, then I thought, this is it.
Right.
We are ridiculing Haman.
Right. And, that's a good point.
Great holiday.
Okay, so a couple more answers, and then we'll finish up. So, this is a little bit deeper of a reason, okay? So, by casting casting lots for his most important decision of when to destroy the Jews, Haman is just demonstrating his beliefs. What beliefs? He was from Amalek, and Amalek believes that the world is run by chance, by happenstance. Things just go randomly, right? There's no order. There's no providence. There's no set ideas. There's no God that's running the world. So as much as Haman believe in the existence of God, as we've said, it seems that Haman acknowledges that there is something to the Jewish people and to God. They reject the idea that God utilizes the world for divine purpose, and thus the very existence of the Jewish people is antithetical to their beliefs. They say, yeah, there's God, and he created the world, but he doesn't, like, he's not involved in the world, and therefore the Jewish people who act like, to, in their eyes, they're acting like there's some sort of, you know, program to follow. That we don't like that, right? There is no such program, right? There's nothing, right? So Haman saw the cycles of history, and he was aware that the Jewish people were at a spiritual low point, right? As much as we say, you know, the Jews needed to be saved by God, but there is ample evidence that the Jewish people were not at their best, right? We're not our best. We, like you said, some of the people may have been bowing down to Haman. Besides from Mordechai, but they attended the party of Achashverosh, which they also may have said, "Oh well, we need to go because it's, you know, and there's going to be kosher food and everything." But Mordechai said we shouldn't go, you know, and there different reasons. But basically, then we weren't at our highest point. So that's why Haman said, oh, well, this is a ripe time. And he said he'll be victorious. Since victory was guaranteed, he would prove through their defeat that a single person could control destiny. Not God, but he could. He could, right? It's human control. However, Purim is a celebration of the fact that the world is not random. Calling the holiday Purim reminds the Jewish people that even when events appear to be happening at random, like in a lottery, God is still the ultimate controller of fate. So the idea that we call it Purim to remind us that that is a mistaken notion, that the lots control what's going on. It's not true, right? It's really God. So it's a way of reminding ourselves that, you know, we call it Purim. In a way, maybe we're mocking Haman, right? Like you were saying with the Gregor, because we're saying, we're going to call our holiday lots, right? It's like calling, you know, a holiday in which an army, you know, I don't know, falls asleep when they were fighting, you know, or a team that, you know, fell asleep, you know, the night before the game and therefore didn't play well. We're going to call this the sleep bowl or the sleep victory to prod them, to poke at them every time they hear it. So maybe that's, we're calling it Purim. Like, You know, you think it's all about the lots. It wasn't about the lots. God was controlling the lots. He wanted it to be in Adar. He wanted to give us time to repent and to pray and to give us 11 months. So we're kind of saying, oh, you know, Purim, you know, it's all about, it's you think it's about the lottery when it's really not. Yeah.
God gave human beings freedom of action.
Yes.
Otherwise, there would be no Yom Kippur.
Yeah, that's true.
So I hold evil people responsible for their evil.
No, absolutely.
But the fact that our little people has survived
right,
4,000
right.
years of history
right.
is a proof that ultimately will be a Mashiach's time, what
yeah.
the world that God wants. But he gave.
No, absolutely.
He
right.
gave human beings. And
right.
Haman was evil. Ahasuerus was evil.
Yeah.
They were evil. The Nazis were evil.
No, absolutely.
God gave human beings this confidence. And
absolutely. So you're touching on the famous idea of free will, which is certainly a Jewish concept.
No Yom Kippur.
No, absolutely. I'm saying that's definitely true. But then, on the other hand, we know there's divine providence, right? God also, you know, shifts things and, you know,
of course,
does step
God.
In. No, so that's what I'm saying. So you're touching on this kind of sort of conflict between these two valid ideas and how to solve them. So, yeah, you're right. But, okay, so the last idea is that... is that actually, and this is like a really interesting idea, actually the word Purim does mean lots, but it also, in Hebrew, could have another meaning, which is, in the Torah, it's sort of a technical passage about vows, right? But this, I would be remiss if I didn't say that this is from a lecture series by Rabbi David Foreman, who's a rabbi in New York. And he says that if you look at in Numbers and Bamidbar in chapter 30, it talks about a woman that makes a vow, and the husband or the father, depending on her age and her marital status, could annul the vow, right?
Yeah.
So, and it's like a discussion, and he only has one day to do it. So, without going into the entire piece, because it's a very elegant piece, the point for us is that the word hefer, which is like poor, hefer means to annul, means to get rid of. Like, it's referring to when the husband can get rid of the wife's vow. So the idea is that Esther, not, forget Haman's, Haman did cast lots, but at the same time, Esther counteracted that by her actions, by being brave and going to the king and working that angle, she was mefir, she counteracted the lots of Haman by doing mefir, by annulling what Haman had come up with in his strategy with the lots. The same word is used in a different context for Esther annulling what Haman did, and Rabbi Foreman goes into an analysis of things that Mordechai said to Esther, which sort of echo the things in the passage about the husband and the wife and the vow, and it's a really nice piece. So, I would be remiss if I said that we'd like to dedicate today's class to my aunt, Riva Frankel's Alaa Shalom. Her 10th Yahrzeit is this week, and so we want to dedicate the learning that we did today for her. So, just to conclude. So we studied the third chapter, and that every chapter is really interesting. Like, I wish we could, you know, study the whole thing, because every chapter has a lot of interesting things to it. But the third chapter is a turning point. Certainly one of the turning points, because it is when Haman comes up with this plan, and it's the point when the Jewish people are at their lowest, meaning they're thinking that they're going to be destroyed, right? Vayir Shushan Nevocha, the Shushanites, the Jewish people, were perplexed at what was going on. But then, obviously, ultimately, they're saved. And then we ask the question, why do we name the holiday Lots, Purim? There could be a lot of other names for it. So we gave a couple answers, one of them being that the Lots was by God, you know, negating the Lots, or Esther, we were saved, right? That's like the miracle. Or we said a deeper reason is that the Lots signal Haman's belief in a random, human-controlled destiny without God's involvement at all. And while we acknowledge that humans make their own choices, but God also...
There's something going on.
God can also step in, and so we want to point out that fact. And then the last idea is that Purim is from the word annulment, which is to get rid of things, which is what Esther did to, or God also, Esther and God, you know, as a team together, got rid of Haman's decree. Next week, we will have another class a couple days before Purim, and we'll study another aspect of the Purim holiday.
And up to date, yes, tell me.